Public Works Department last minute piece.
acknowledge that we would need to intensify our energy efficiency transition to a super clean program and all our other energy efficient measures, we do acknowledge that, and we will also take that back to our new DG in our report to intensify our capacity as soon as possible so this can be achieved. In terms of procurement of goods and other services, including cars, etc., my understanding that this would fall under the Treasury Amber to who sets the guidelines, etc., for procurement. So I'm assuming that engagement with National Treasury would have to transpire and that then can be cascaded to all government departments as well as municipalities in terms of procurement of other goods and services. And with regard to the local manufacturers, where we can encourage job creation through local manufacturing of light bulbs and other technologies, that I think must be embodied in, I think it's a good point, and it must be embodied into the green building framework. So we will also engage our policy unit in that regard. So thank you for that. We will definitely take that through. The baseline, we acknowledge that as well, and I think we alluded to that in the presentation. The baseline audit that were concluded, we did start the program, Chair, in 1997. And the baseline audits conducted was mainly done by contractors and the property administrators. Where we were lacking was to have an M&E unit. We lacked it then, we lack it now, and that's what we've alluded to as well in our presentation, to say that we've engaged Treasury to get that capacity on board to assist us to do the audit checks and balances in those regards. With regard to the Department of Education, currently they fall under the competency of the provincial administration. However, notwithstanding that, we do have a concurrent mandate, almost an oversight role with provinces. There were discussions with the previous MINMAC, with MECs, etc., to consolidate the efforts across all departments, including provinces, etc. So discussions in that regard are being taken forward by my minister. So we not only conform to the framework that has been developed, but we also start to be measured accordingly. The IDT, they've been re-established as a Schedule 2 public entity and a property management agency reporting to the Minister of Public Works. They generally support all spheres of government in delivery of their mandate. Through program management implementation agreement. But if there's further questions in and around there, I'm sure that will assist me in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. The key thing, as long as they have appropriate energy efficiency capacity or capability to drive that area. One of the members who are pretty late came to say that I think one thing that fundamentals are coming up, which I've seen somewhere else as well, is what one can coin is green procurement. We should be very, very firm about that memo detail. I know it's the National Treasury that should look into that, but it's very important. Imagine with the buying capacity the government has had, the influence would have, it would ensure green procurement, because it means those who do government, business with government, they cannot have the end, they are factories or have one section to do business for government. They just have to be green in the way they produce stuff for everyone, not just government. Honorable Felini, see, we achieve that.
I had a question, Chair. It's just a suggestion, possibly. I mean, the department was seeding with regards to the EDSM program and getting more funds from Treasury. What I think would be helpful, though, is if we could get a document that talks about how far the EDSM program has gone, how much has been saved in terms of energy, all of those things in the different municipalities, and how much has been spent to do that, I think it would also strengthen our hand in terms of going to Treasury to say that more money needs to be given. So I just think if Tolga and yourself can work on that, I think that would be a very helpful document.
I hope the department and the SAL can pick it up. Can you take it as a format request now so that it comes back to the committee formally, at least within, at the most within 4 to 6 weeks, or that means very clear within 6 weeks, then we can start working on it. Thank you. Green Billy, over to you, then. Welcome, compliments, and everything. Once again, thanks very much for hosting us. By the way, one of the members and others will remember, we did visit one of the buildings, with a member to the Green Buildings Council, just to see how they integrate energy efficiency, not just from a retrofitting angle, but from actually design angle. That's really what impressed us. In what you see at the Heraton building in Oricon building in the Central City. Over to you, gentlemen. Introduce yourself. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair, members of the committee, colleagues. My name is Brian Wilkinson. I'm the Chief Executive of the Green Building Council of Africa. I'm very delighted to have my colleague Manfred Brown, who's our technical genius with us. He heads up our development of our rating tools and certification process, and my colleague Jared Lewin, who has been driving our stakeholder outreach program. Honourable Chair, we interpreted our brief under the following main headings. We wanted to do an introduction of what the Green Building of Council of South Africa is. We wanted to talk just a little bit about the Green Star South Africa registration and certification mechanism. We wanted to talk about the role of energy within the Green Star rating system. Green buildings is a lot more than just energy, but we recognize that this system is focusing specifically on the energy component. We wanted to give you some really good feedback on the public sector participation in the movement, and then we wanted to reflect perhaps on some of our current challenges and perhaps some recommendations. So just
thank for that. I think what we'll do, Honourable Members, is to look at the program and see if the presentation has gone according to what we requested. Because I think the earlier representation, we still have to come back to them in writing. There are certain areas that were missed according to what we requested. Sorry, it's not pointing at you. See, that's a trigger that I want to be on record. We will come back to people who have not covered areas that we thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just our credentials. We are just over 5 years old. In fact, we celebrated our fifth birthday at our convention last year in October. We're a not-for-profit organization. We are the only officially recognized Green Building Authority in the country. We're a full member, and this is very significant, we're a full member of the World Green Building Council, and our current chair is in fact the vice chair of the World Green Building Council. The World Green Building Council comprises 92 green building councils around the world. And we also chair at South Africa the...
Which means 92 countries.
92 countries, yes. We also chair on behalf of the World Green Building Council, we chair the Africa Network of Green Building Councils. And if we have the opportunity, I may go into some of the fantastic stuff that is happening with our northern neighbours. Our vision, very simply, is to transform the South African property industry to ensure that all of our buildings are designed, built, and operated in an environmentally sustainable way. We tend to summarize this with a rather bold statement to say we want to change the way the world is built. Why we do this? We do this because the built environment is a huge contributor to the last week. The built environment generates about a third of greenhouse gas emissions. Just some real statistics, about 40% of solid waste generation comes from the water sector, 12% of fresh water consumption, and specifically for the interest of this committee, 40% of end use energy consumption is from this sector. The reason why we believe that the built environment has a very significant role to play is that it offers one of the quickest opportunities to do something about climate change. Yes, we can do something about the way we generate electricity. It's going to take a long time. Built environments, and we're going to show you some slides later on, the built environment offers the opportunity to do some very real and very significant things in a very, very short space of time. We refer to that as the abatement opportunity. Our approach has always been to lead, so to try and pull the market forward, and this graph sort of shows it, where we say that building regulations in many respects become the floor, the have-tos. And then the leaders, the Oricon that you mentioned earlier, Armchair, lead the market and sort of pull the market towards that so that it changes over time. To do this, and this, as I said, this rather bold initiative of trying to change the way the world is built, we have a number of initiatives. We create awareness of why green building. And that tries to take our stakeholders really through a process of initially simply understanding green building, moving on to understanding the benefits of green building, making the commitment to green building, and then ultimately, I know it's not the forum to mention them, but there certainly are some companies that have become true green building ambassadors. They've in fact embedded green building into their branding and into the way they market themselves. We do.
I do ask Public Works to join that ambassadorial session and conceit. I'm committing them in front of the board.
Honourable Chair, it was delightful to renew acquaintance with my colleague at the Department of Public Works. We go back a little way, and they Public Works is a significant stakeholder, and they are on board, and we will be reporting on that.
My emphasis, green building ambassador. Yes. And you can only be a green building ambassador when you qualify to reach that level, isn't it? There's a threshold to get into that fraternity.
And will help the department every step of the way.
Bye, thank you.
I spoke about awareness. We also form an education role. We have a number of educational programs. We have already trained over 3,000 people in green buildings. We accredit professionals, so there's an exam process. We have over 400, we have 500 people that are accredited professionals. One of our seminal pieces of work last year was the so-called Rands and Sense of Green Buildings, and Sense spelled S-E-N-S-E rather than the other one, which tried to say that not only is there a very significant sort of noble imperative of doing something about climate change, in respect to green buildings there's a very, very significant economic business case that supports it. And clearly, in respect of electrical consumption or energy usage, that's one of the biggest payback items. If you can reduce the amount of energy your building is consuming, you're saving operating costs. So a very strong economic case, and we have workshops on the RAND, so-called RAND percent of green building. We've also recently started doing some programs within organizations, so not just public programs. We will go in and do a sort of a bespoke type training program to a specific either association or corporation. We always try to say that none of what we do, there's no single piece that is more important than others, but if there is a piece that we really have to get right, it's this recognition of excellence. We have developed what we call the Green Star South Africa rating system. Green Star SA is a uniquely South African rating system. We adapted some of the work our Australian cousins have done. We localized that and we've built something that is now unique to South Africa. four rating tools currently. So we have a rating tool for offices, we have a rating tool for multi-unit residential properties, a public and education building tool. In the public sector, we're very generous in fact sponsoring the purpose of the public and education building tool. And then we have a retail building tool. These rating tools are for new buildings and assess both new buildings in respect of how they were designed and then how they were built. And sorry, my colleagues just mentioned also for major refurbishments in retrofit. We will be completing very early this year, and we are incredibly proud of this, a new category to our rating system, which is a socio-economic category. It's a world first. We did that because green buildings has to be a lot, cannot only be about the way you use energy and the way you use water and how you site your building to take advantage of transport networks. It also has to address how your building talks to the community. So have you used your development project as an opportunity to create jobs? Have you used your development project as an opportunity to upskill people? Have you used your development as an opportunity to source material from local suppliers? So we have developed, and in fact it is complete in a draft form. It has to go through a few more stages, but we hope to launch that fairly soon. I mentioned that we're very proud of it. It is a world first. We have also done it on behalf, in conjunction with the World Green Building Council and our developing country colleagues. And that will now be presented to the World Green Building Council as a framework which other developing countries can incorporate in their own ratings. Given the discussion that happened just previously, very significantly is our ambition to develop a Green Star performance tool, which is now a rating tool for existing buildings. So up until now, I mentioned that we've really focused on new builds and on major retrofits, as my colleague pointed out. Existing building takes us into this huge universe. The new build is kind of a constrained sector. An existing building or performance tool takes us into a whole new universe. And we feel that we're ready for that. We've earned, we've earned our spurs in terms of the take-up of green building. Sitting alongside the existing building tool is a Green Star SA interiors tool. And for the first time, this now gives a tenant, and you were chatting about public works earlier on, this gives a tenant the opportunity to do a green fit-up. This is no longer just the outside of the building, it's how you use the inside of the building. I mentioned categories. Our rating systems have 10 categories. We've highlighted energy because that's the reason why we're here this afternoon today. But so that I present a holistic picture, the 10 categories are management, and that's how you've managed the project process, the indoor environmental policy, possibly one of the most important categories, energy itself, transport, obviously. Transport talks not only to how your building is funded to access transport networks, but also whether you've done innovative things. The Honourable Chair mentioned the Oricon building. They've done some fairly clever things like prioritize parking for hybrid vehicles that have cycle facilities and showers on site, so use of alternative transport. Innovation, where we try to acknowledge and reward in the rating system very innovative things that have been done. Water consumption, obviously, materials, land use and ecology, emissions and the socio-economic categories that I just mentioned. In respect of the energy category within Green Star, it really is about promoting cost-effective greenhouse gas mitigation on Earth. We look at four main sections. So how you divide the building up and sub-meter your energy measurements. The lighting power density, we traditionally over-light our buildings. Very easy way to save electricity. Lighting zone. efficiency programs that have been done, but then when people go home, they still leave the lights on. So lighting zoning tries to, first of all, make the zones smaller, and then also to install things like occupancy switches and what have you, and then peak energy demand reduction. We developed last year, and it is currently in pilot format, something that is again a first for South Africa, an energy and real estate marketing tool. We serve, together with our members, survey just over 300 buildings in various locations around the country, various sites, which is office building, and have developed a benchmarking tool so that any, and we have made this available to market on a free-to-use basis, any building owner can now download this tool, can key in their specific data, and will get an output that explains where their building is relative to the national benchmark. Now this becomes very, very significant. In our space, which often talks to commercial property owners, they, if their buildings are performing better than a benchmark, they would be wanting to market this to their tenants and to their potential tenants. If their buildings were performing worse than a benchmark, they would be using this to inform retrofits, to inform investment in their buildings. They might also be using it to inform longer-term strategies, saying, well, maybe we actually just want to get rid of this building. Certification is early on in the process. We, in fact, that should be 29. We have 29 certifications in our short five-year history, but it's actually not 5 years because we really have only been certified for 3 years. And this game is not about numbers, but if we match ourselves to our Australian colleagues who are currently sitting at 500 certifications, we are, after 5 years, exactly, in fact, marginally ahead, but more or less where they were. And what we're seeing is a doubling every single year. So the slide does say 31 buildings have already registered for certification. So hopefully we'll be at 60 buildings by the end of this year, 120 buildings by the end of this year. So 20% of those were public sector buildings. And I wanted to show that the committee was, unfortunately, it's a rendering. It's not complete yet. But this is the first national government building that has achieved a Green Star rating, achieved a 4-star Green Star rating. It is designed to use 35% less energy than the standard. That building is Victoria. Right here in Cape Town, the Manningburg Contact Center, which is the city of Cape Town building, also a Green Star building, 80% less energy usage. Colleagues in KZN have developed the most beautiful building. In fact, this photograph doesn't do it justice. But the most beautiful building in the Corpo, which is, the chair may remember when you read Pride of a Beloved Country, the beautiful road that Alan Page refers to ends in the Corpo. This particular building is a 5-star, green-star building, the first public sector 5-star. 5-star is very, very significant. It's a high bar that they've achieved. What was significant about this, and the public sector can be very, very proud, this building, or this project, was also recognized as having presented the highest quality submission to the Green Building Council in our 5 years. Asatar, which is now a commercial building and from the CBD of Johannesburg, 60% less energy consumption. Vodafone, this is our only 6-star building in the country. So our green building rating system, we have a 4-star rating, which stands for South African Best Practice, a 5-star, which is South African Excellence, and a 6-star, which is a world-class building. We only currently have one. We hope to very soon have a lot more than just one, and we obviously have some inside information. Perhaps next time I'll be able to report that we have a lot more than one. But our only 6-star building is a little building in Midrand, which very cleverly has made its entire roof out of photovoltaic panels. It generates double the electricity that is required. It knows those 3 days the sort of independent bathroom uses population, it loans the spare electricity it generates to the building next door to it, which is also a Vodafone format. That's not the same site, but they are legally allowed to do that. And then at night, when the sun's not shining, it says, can we have our electricity back, please? So it's effectively using the building next door to that. Putting on Oak is our first multi-unit residential building, which is 75% less energy. Very significant change was that when this building achieved its green building rating, the developers saw a market increase in interest from potential buyers of apartments in the building. So the public has actually embraced the energy efficiency opportunities that a building such as this can present. Chair, I think we did report on this the last time we presented to yourself. In the run-up to COP17 at the end of 2011, we wanted to do something in South Africa that would be a bit of a legacy project. We did the first green street retrofit in the country. A small number of houses, this was with the generous support of the British High Commission. We were able to do a complete retrofit of 30 houses. You'll see in that slide sort of ring with the little green demarcation. We like to say we did the big five. So we did some solar water heating, we did some ceiling insulation, some food gardening, the rainwater harvesting, and some lighting. This project has punched so far above its weight in terms of interest from a huge number of bodies. So much so that the Australian High Commission, perhaps not what we have done, but the British High Commission, have now funded an upgrade to those buildings in the foreground. So just on this little corner, and that was in fact completed just last week. Sorry, 2 weeks ago, and we opened it last week. So that was a legacy project that we did, and is some of what we do. I said that the public sector can be very proud of its participation in the Green Building Movement. We would like to volunteer that the role of the public sector is one of leading by example, and I think that was mentioned by one of the honourable members earlier on, clearly to legislate, and in many, many instances, simply to facilitate. I was having a discussion with my Department of Public Works colleagues, and I mentioned to them how the Australian government played a facilitation role by saying we as significant tenants and significant users of the built environment, we will not tenant a building, either the own building or if it was a leased building, we will not tenant a building unless it conforms to certain energy standards. And that, of course, played a huge facilitation role. And perhaps
I think that's what Honorable Mlod was alluding when he was asking, although it was that your question, that do you focus on your own building? What about this building? And I added in a sense that what extent are you putting these preconditions that are being represented here? Now the cat is out of the bag, public works, because that was a loaded question, that why are you not putting preconditions when you're putting in, right now, sorry to detract you, right now, Department of Public Works through the minister, they are reviewing EEDC, isn't it? And it's public knowledge. Why not ensure that, other than ensuring the integrity of the process, but why not ensure that there's a lot of green procurement inserted in that? Sorry, you are guilty of trivial.
Honorable Chair, please, the Department of Public Works are colleagues, please don't do anything that will damage that. The public buildings, and I showed you a couple of photographs, there are now public buildings that have been certified at all levels. So national government, provincial government, local government, and even state-owned enterprise. SANRAL, for one, has a green star building. the Department of Public Works has gazetted that they acknowledge the Green Star essay, four-star Green Star essay, as being best practice for officers. I've spoken about the previous reference to the energy efficiency legislation that has been passed. And right now, we are working with the department in terms of the development of energy performance certificates. We've worked with the Department of Energy in terms of your strategy and your competency to your strategy. So there's a good interface happening. There are, however, there will always be challenges, and we have been so bold as to make a few recommendations. Some of the challenges really is increasing the level of awareness and education. And that really addresses what in some instances is a low technical capacity within organizations and within the public sector itself. Clearly, one of the challenges is building capacity to deliver against the national carbon emission targets. This is, you know, our country is a complex one, and to try and create synergy within all of these disparate organizations is complicated, even within the public sector itself. But then the additional layer of complexity is when we have the private sector and the public sector trying to work together. The good news is that the transition to a low-carbon economy is prioritized in terms of the National Development Plan. And I think our role and one of the challenges will be how do we create an enabling environment for this to happen. Some recommendations. So I coined the word BHAG, Big Hairy Audacious Goals. Perhaps a VAG chair is that all new government buildings should be built green by 2020, and perhaps 50% of the largest, 50% of existing government buildings should have water, energy, and waste measurement systems in place and improvements. And then I know it's the chair's
too far. It depends on our members. Too far. Okay, good.
I happen to know that this is the chair who has spoken to me about it. We would love to be able to support Parliament in doing a retrofit of this building, because then it is in the legislative space every single day. So we'd love to be part of that journey. And then I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't try and do a little bit of advertising. We are very, very proud of the fact that we will be hosting the World Green Building Council Convention in Cape Town in South Africa at the end of this year. And I certainly hope that we will be all of our colleagues at the time. Thank you very much.
And I would even invite us. Thank you very much. Can we move to the Foundry Network? That's the chief. Thank you very much. Okay, over to the foundry.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair and members of the committee and colleagues. We'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present to you the status quo of the within the metals manufacturing sector. My name is Audrey Al-Mohammadi. I'm the project leader of the National Foundry Technology Network, and my colleague is here is from industry, representing the champion of the energy. We've got a working group. So he's the champion of the energy working group, and he's from AutoCOS. This slide just shows you that what exactly we mean with the National Foundry Technology Network. We believe that the only way that we really truly can make a difference is government, industry, and the research institutions as well as academia come together and we solve the problem together. It's only then that we will really come to have the right answers to the questions and the problems that we are encountering. The agenda for our presentation is that we will look at the South African foundry industry in South Africa, what is the role of the National Foundry Technology Network, existing incentive programs, and then the energy tariffs and efficiency in the sector, success stories within the industry, and then challenges and recommendations. I must just apologize, there might be some changes of the order of the slides that I've made. The National Foundry Technology Network is established by the Department of Trade and Industry as part of the IFAC as a key action program under the metal fabrication, capital and transport equipment. The NFTN is administered by the CFR to ensure that we are adhering to the CFMA, and the NFTN is a culmination of a significant government and industry association effort. Our vision is to facilitate the development of a globally competitive South African foundry industry. And this is through a provision of appropriate services, and by that we would like to ensure that we reduce import leakage, increase local production, and increase investment in our industry. So the South African industry, foundry industry, how does it look? We've got about 180 production plant in South Africa, and unfortunately that is reduced from about 2,000 from 400. Big plants of about 1,000 people, but we also have very small family-owned plants that employing about 20 people. We've got international companies as well as family-owned companies. Some of the foundries are in-house within the larger manufacturing industry, and then we've got iron, aluminium, zinc, bronze, special alloys that are being produced by these plants. There are high level of flexibility and engineering versatility. Added value within the foundry industry could be something like machining, coating, and assembly. And these foundries are spread all over the country, like Harking, Fayetteville, Western Cape, and Eastern Cape. But with a large number of foundries, about 60% of them residing within the Ekurhuleni. Just to show you how the industry per site has how they've shrunk since about 2003 to 2011, and we want to make special notice of. If we look at 2007, we know that what happened after 2007. 2008 power surges came, and there is a clear indication of how our foundries have suffered during that period. From 2003 and 2007, there's not very little reduction in numbers of foundries, but since 2007 until 2011, there's a huge number of foundries that have closed down. Some of them have amalgamated.
Unfortunately, the colors are good, but you can't see the figures. The second last column, number of foundries in, that's about 67.
So first in 2011.
Okay, thank you.
And the number of foundries is 184. Foundries and employment. Direct employment is estimated about 12,000 to 15,000, and with 20,000 people employed in processing and components. Employment is estimated to have reduced with 10 to 15% since 2008. And this was from a survey done with about 24 foundries. And here we've just listed some of the foundries that have closed down since 2008. And please note the number of jobs that we've lost through that. For instance, Eclipse, a 500 job loss, and the latest one end of last year was Crown Park, that closed its doors and another 130 jobs. So many plants have even reduced their numbers of employment because of the difficulties that they are in. Investment in the foundry industry in the last 4 years has really been insignificant, but there are exceptions to that where you find that there are some that are invested. And then just taking the employment from a different angle, if we look at the employment of the direct 15,000 and we use the appropriate multiplier for our sector, then, and I've used about a 3.5 multiplier, then we're looking at about 52,000 employees in supporting the industry. And this is really taking it very conservative. The markets that are served by the South African foundry industry are automotive, mining, general engineering, those three being the largest, but also construction, agriculture, and other. And under others could be household goods. The export and we both export and local markets. Export meaning often that it's going into other, into the country and then only being exported. So there is a large number of our products are done and are exported. High competitive environment within the foundry industry and competitive with the rest. Foundries and its market, just a bit of facts on that. The main customers are global companies. The market is extremely well developed and pricing must be global. Pricing is on a global level. Buyers are price sensitive and can choose from any supply location. And even if the foundries might not think that they are or they're only competing with a foundry next door, they are competing very much in China and India. Foundry products are commoditized. The sale of local products often are too small to fill our foundries in South Africa. So we really need that global supply chain to make sure that we are also supplying to the automotive contract implies price reduction over lifetime. So there's no increase for if the energy increases, it, you cannot carry that over to the customers within the automotive industry. And increased imports to South Africa as a result of rising costs. Just to show you a number of examples of products that are being produced by foundry. A very proud plant is an accessory, you're never 2 meters away from a car seat. So whether you open your fridge in the morning, whether you switch your kettle on, whether you touch your car, wherever you are, you will always be very, very close to the car seat. And for us in South Africa, that has a huge impact on whether we really, really are serious about our improving or making our metal manufacturing sector more competitive. Because without the foundry industry, there is no metal manufacturing sector. Sorry. Sorry. Just to bring this into perspective of the energy, this is just one of the objectives of the National Foundry Technology Network, the cleaner production objective, where we say we want to assist foundries to embrace principles of cleaner production, which includes both both materials and energy management. And as a drive, we then in 2011 produced this manual. I brought some sources with for members that would be interested in having a look. This is a self-help tool for families to really use that and compare themselves, learn to measure, and reduce the efficiency in the family itself. We've made it a nice sturdy manual that they can use it on the floor and really, you know, without having to bring in consultants to try and reduce the efficiency as much as they can on the floor. Then I just want, from NFTN side, we have started to, with a competitive improvement initiative where we try to ensure that we, on the plant, start to improve foundry efficiency. And by that, what we do is we do an assessment, a baseline assessment. The baseline assessment compares the foundry's, do a comparison of the foundry, how they fare in terms of scrap reduction, the scrap rate, the efficiency rate, the productivity in, at that point in time. And we compare it both with a media, a local medium as well as an international medium, in order for them to see where they are. What we then give the foundries the report to show them what are the cost percentages for material, energy, labor, equipment, overhead, and do a recommendation of what would be the percentage saving on cost that they would experience, because companies would like to talk about. They want to know what is the saving on the bottom line. And from that, we make a recommendation then, alongside with the foundry, to say, okay, but what would you like to do about this? Part of that agreement then, we set targets for a period of time. We look at an energy efficiency initiative with each foundry of about 15 to 18 months. And targets are then set clearly to say, within that period, we would like to see your energy intensity be reduced to 12%. We would like to see a reject rate, a reduction of 12%, and productivity improvement of 15%. It's then our job during that period to assist with numerous processes to ensure that this is being done. And from our side, we then report to our stakeholders as to how those companies are faring in that regard. In this case, for instance, one of the foundries just started in October. We've introduced gas as an alternative energy source, but you can see, so the reduction of gas is the purple line, the green line is the energy that's been reduced, and the overall red line shows the target that we would like to reach, and the blue line is where we are at the moment, how far we come to really attain that target. So this is what we're doing on plant level with foundries, and the learning that we get from that we aggregate to the foundry industry as a whole. Like, for instance, in the case of this self-help manual. Other incentive programs within government where it is relevant to the foundry industry, for instance, the Eskom demand side management program. Response, however, on that is that industry utilizes the IGM incentive for efficient water heaters and lights. So that is where how far we have come, and you will see later on.
IGM, please.
You will see later on in the presentation that the water heaters and lights, how very small percentage of the usage within a foundry really that makes up. And then potential savings are where we use most energy. In the less of melting and thermal processes, we do not have the capacity of it within South Africa to assist with that. So here I'm saying the ESCOs that are implementers of the ESCOM programs often are not specialized in melting and metal melting, and they're often overcharged. ESCOM programs do not focus on municipal users, and process is cumbersome. So we've seen that often as soon as the municipality comes that we introduce a foundry under a municipal region, then it becomes much more difficult to try and get that process. Investment rebates require upfront funding from the foundry itself, which in many cases is difficult for because of the cost that's involved with that. And no incentive for investment in alternative energy such as the gas. Other incentives that are also is the energy energy service. The other incentives that are also relevant to the foundry industry is the IDP's with the PAYW Green Energy Efficiency Fund, where a loan is offered at prime money to support competitiveness through energy savings. The other one is the DCI Metal Manufacturing Efficiency Efficiency Fund, MSEC, where the incentive program aims to support competitive improvements through energy efficiency improvement, green efficiency, a number of areas that they are covering, but in this case the energy efficiency. But this one is quite new. Response from the industry in this regard is that many foundries have attempted to apply for these above. A number of foundries have attempted with our assistance, with very little success due to requirements, the processes, and the disbursement policies that are part of these incentive programs. Energy efficiency programs from government, according to the industry, is that they reside with so many government departments and so many agencies that it just confuses the industry as to where they should be going to and what is relevant to them. Discussions currently are underway with the DTI to try and reach the gap in terms of the energy program for the industry. I'm handing over then to Mark.
Honourable Chair, honourable members, gentlemen, we'll just continue explaining our situation. And obviously in the foundries we convert metal, we melt metal and we put it in a product. So by nature we are very energy intensive. Just to give you an example how important energy is for us. In an iron foundry, 18% of overall costs can be energy. That would mean taking out the material, 30% of added value being energy. So energy has a massive impact on the foundry's operation, on the foundry's costs, and on the foundry's existence. I don't really want to talk about tariffs, because I know tariffs is not a scope of this meeting, but it must be clear that there is a very strong link between tariffs and energy efficiency. And as such, I will need to highlight the importance of the tariffs and its effect as to what is happening in the industry. Everybody knows the energy cost, particularly electricity, has been escalating dramatically from 2008 onwards. In 2008, up to 2008, actually, we were getting electricity at a very low price. And really from 2011, we actually got it at prices where we were not competitive anymore in relation to our overseas, some of our overseas competitors. Just to summarize here, so for the foundries to be prosperous and grow, which is obviously our target, create jobs, we must really have two conditions. So first of all, we must have access to competitive tariffs, and we must be energy efficient. So energy efficiency is not a matter of choice, it's a matter of survival. Just to highlight the situation of the tariffs. Almost all members in our industry procure electricity through the municipalities. So everybody knows that there's a large discrimination in this country between customers who buy directly from ESCOM and customers who buy through the municipalities. The municipalities typically charge 50% more than ESCOM. know, there's this whole hoo-ha at this moment about NYPD3, and it's very, very well publicized in all the newspapers, but it really only affects 50% of the customers in this country. The other 50% are in a much worse condition. So as a result of that, for us, for the foundries, the power is already more expensive than now the main another very important factor is that the escalation of the tariffs and the increases have gone very, very fast. So really from 2008 onwards, we suddenly had these 25% to 30% yearly increases. So it's gone very fast, and also the timing of it was very good because it came in the midst of a recession, and as an industry, we have managed to come out of that recession. Another remark of tariffs is that electricity tariffs for the industry are not cost effective, which means that basically the industry pays relatively more for electricity than what other users pay, and that is also very clearly described into ESCOM's NYPDT application. So ESCOM then obviously on top of that with the NYPDT application as which is currently on the wall has added a lot of uncertainty. So really what we are asking for is that we need a national strategy for electricity tariffs for energy intensive users. We cannot depend on local governments for strategic matters. And at this point in time, we completely depend on local governments around certain prices. This graph or this overview just shows you how electricity prices have escalated since 2000. So it includes the NYPD3 increases as presented by ESCOM. So you see that between 2000 and 2015, we will see electricity prices grow by 7 times, while the PPI, the producer price index, actually only goes up by 2.6 times. And very important is that you also see that the municipal tariffs have increased by the same amount, meaning that the market from the municipality in percentage has remained the same, and in absolute terms has grown incredibly. Just as an example, this is Nelson Mandela Bay. We know that our municipality extracts about 800 million rand on an annual basis out of the electricity account. So, but in the meantime, we still hear from Salga that we need grants for energy efficient projects. So for us, that is very, very difficult to understand. But important is the yellow point in 2010, where we already had tariffs in as high as some of the Western European countries, and then from 2011 onwards, we actually became higher. And if you see where we're going with NYPDC, there will be no industry left, no national strategy really comes to some decisions. So as I said, next to tariffs, energy efficiency in foundries is also a matter of survival. Surviving industry, the industry that is still there, because we have reduced quite significantly already, is under continuous cost pressure and has reduced its energy consumption to a large extent. So we have done that, we can do that by two ways. First of all, it's reducing waste, improve operation practices, and the second way is obviously buying better equipment, which is more efficient. Obviously, the investment routes for us it's very difficult because at this point in time we are in industry under pressure and we actually don't really have the funds to invest in our industry. So we really have moved towards competitive energy efficiency mainly by reducing wastage. And I just want to show you some examples, verifiable examples of some foundries. Iron foundry in Eastern Cape. In 2009, we had an energy usage of 48 GWh. If we convert that in GWh from solar, that gave a number of 3,850. And actually, last year, we managed to reduce the 15 GWh to 2,760. That's an improvement of 30%. So that is massive. And obviously, the driver for that improvement was mainly the increased tariff. same time, you also managed to reduce our costs. We used to run 9.5 MVA, and we have been able to reduce it to 6.5 MVA. And we're not at the end yet. We target to reduce another 10% this year. And this saving has really been achieved in focusing our production around the energy usage, which means that energy is our main, we consider that as our main cost driver. And really, you know, guides our plants and our whole production process is run around the lowest energy usage. But before, we, for example, the lowest input costs or the lowest energy usage. So now it's around the lowest energy. We employ energy saving specialists. We have the support from the AIDC, so we do all these things. You can also see that the ESCOM IDM, the Integrated Demand Management, is really used. Only a minor contribution. Two other examples from the found in the thing, which also saved a massive amount of energy. The foundry here in this town, several measures were put into data improvements, and these are actually verified results. Now I come to the point of the hurdles. The hurdles towards the prosperous and energy efficient foundry. Again, a prosperous foundry is also an energy efficient foundry. So I think for us it's a matter of survival. The first thing is electricity is too expensive. Although higher prices will drive energy efficiency improvement, and the prices are too high, investment is being stopped. And you know, this country will then eventually lose its industry. Regarding investment incentives, we think we could get much better support, and I will explain myself in the following comments. If you look at ESCOM's NYPDC application, and we really consider ESCOM as the main driver of energy savings in this country. The target they have for NYPDC for the next 5 years actually significantly less than 1% of total usage. So let's say the whole IDM project saves less than 1% of energy on an annual basis. So we really think that this is not enough, and we can do a lot better. One of the remarks we want to make is that incentives must be optimized in line with ESCOM avoiding costs. ESCOM now, for example, awards around 4,000 rand per kilowatt saved. But in the meantime, if you look through the document, they need to invest 25,000 rand per kilowatt in capacity. So there's a mismatch there. So we believe the investment grants towards energy savings could be improved much more in line with ESCOM program. There's other hurdles, such as upfront investment. Under the current programs, there's full upfront investment from the industry, so that is obviously a difficulty. And we only get our benefits later on, up to 3 years after the implementation of the program. Current programs also require complicated administration and management from users. We can use the ESCOs, which were already mentioned, but they are very expensive, and they largely annihilate the investment credits which are available to us. So basically, you use an outside company, and then there's no more benefit into your capital investments. There's other things, like, for example, there's no incentive for fault factors improvement anymore. That really could all be. So we think the whole ESCOM IDM program must be accepted and must be much stronger than what it is at the moment. Another point which we want to make is that there's no credit for using alternative energy sources for 2030. If electricity is such a big issue and the availability of electricity is such a big issue in this country, there's lots of users that could convert to gas. But yeah, there's absolutely no incentives for anybody to do so. Further remark we want to make is that the municipality's involvement in IDM for the customers really non-existing. We haven't seen anything from our municipalities towards any way of reducing societies have, you know, interest in this position, because they obviously make a lot of money out of it. So let's be used for the worst day or not. So there's no incentive. So just to summarize our recommendations, we really need a national strategy that is discrimination between municipalities, and direct customers must be end. Otherwise, a big part of the industry will suffer and is already suffering very badly. Energy intensive users must get competitive because of tariffs, and the municipalities, which have absolutely no value in our supply chain, must be and then the second point is also to identify the IBM investments in the specific incentives for the industry for further energy efficiency improvements and conversion to benefit the users. So that's really what I want to bring to the table. I just want to add that obviously our factories are always, you know, open to you if you want to see what we are doing regarding energy improvements, also for the departments of energy that they are on in our government. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Mertan. Let's move to B. The only thing I can say to you is to show that we share a list of your members, all of us as members, I'm sure. We can take our time to just copy and agree to the founder, which would be very helpful.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chairman and committee members. My name is Erika Johnson. I am accountable for Enterprise Development in Eskom. We are very pleased to come and present a review of our 49M campaign. In the interest of time, I'd like to hand over to the division executive who is running this program. We have our IDM specialist here as well, and our strategic marketing team also answer any focused questions around those topics. Over to you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. It's indeed a great pleasure to get this opportunity to present on this campaign 49 years. We received an invitation with a number of questions that we are going to respond to, and in the interest of time, I will not go through each and every question, but they are there for you as members of the Chair. And in trying to respond to those questions, Chair, we developed our presentation under the following points, the index. You have written the handout that we gave up, a number of headings that we are going to try to go through, and by so doing, how to respond to all the questions that are asked of us. For them, it is a catalyst for change. It is a social campaign that aims to encourage people to adopt energy efficient lifestyles and behaviors. It is a way to mobilize the entire nation to band together to contribute to a better future economically, socially, and environmentally. At the core of our strategy, our strategic theme is about showing how small, simple changes can look to making a huge difference for the country, as I said, economically, socially, and environmentally. Our audience, Chair, is almost everybody in South Africa. We try to ensure through this campaign that we touch all South Africans, and you will see in our presentation our attempts to do so. These are the faces that we went to, Chair. I will just mention the top part, the faces themselves. The phase one where we were, our hope was to raise awareness of the initiative itself, and phase two, and the building of the momentum, and the phase two will come to hand in March. And thereafter, Chair, we believe that we will then go in trying to make sure that we sustain the momentum. This campaign is to ensure that we entrench all the things that we appeal to South Africans to do, must be part and parcel of our everyday life. So, the first phase has said we to raise awareness, the second to build momentum, the third to sustain the momentum. What is it that we did under the three phases? The first phase, Chair, was the launch phase. And you'll see as we go through the phase itself, the advertising launches that we made. The launch, Chair, was done by the Deputy President, Alma Mutasa, and it was supported by the Minister of Energy and the Minister of Public Enterprises. And also, as you can see from that photo, are the members of the different organizations that were invited, which we can refer to as the very first members of the Continental Campaign. And these are different organizations, the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the National African Federation Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and many other organizations that were invited when the Deputy was launching this campaign. This pie chart indicates, Chair, and maybe we'll be able to, when you ask us questions, to go deeper, because we can be able to drill and show you as you can see. But I'm not going to do so now in the interest of time. Just to show you the amount of coverage we got. That is here, we did not pay out this money. But when we did a study and look at all the type of articles that were written, the more activations and the media coverage, that is the amount that come up there, Chair. We did TV, we did print, we did audio, we did your, what do we refer to this, the billboards, Chair, and cinema campaigns. We try, as we said, you know, we're trying to touch all South Africans through this campaign, just to indicate all sorts of the strangers, the advertising media. Now, phase two, Chair, as we said in phase two, is now to build the momentum. And we continue, and these are the channels that we work TV, cinema, print, radio, and then the execution and the duration and all the size of, another the duration of the advert for the size in the newspaper. Advertisement. The pillars of this campaign, Chair, five of them, activations, to try, and as we said, Chair, at the core of this is to try and reach all South Africans. The activation where we have the dark houses in malls, the target market, LSM 5%, and you can see we have climate relations, we'll show you that as we go deeper or further into our presentation. The LSM 1 to 4 where the minister plays a major role, our partner program, our ambassador program, and the promotion and sponsorship. These are the different pillars whose attempt is to ensure that we touch all the South Africans with this campaign, Chair. Number of articles, print, broadcast, online, month-to-month performance, Chair. I'm moving a bit faster in the interest of time, Chair. Some of the topics that were written and published that include in the different channels that I alluded to. As I said in the report also, we tried to work with the minister, we worked with the minister, Chair, we worked with the Minister of Public Enterprises, and these are the areas that we have visited last year, Kwazi Kuma, Gugulethu, Tshwane, Mamelodi, Umlazi, and Udastani. And maybe, I don't know what I'm trying to say. We don't have the link in this session, unfortunately, Chair. This is the cabinet supporter, last year's cabinet supporter. All cabinet members also signed the pledge, and as you can see them wearing the Continental campaign t-shirt. Our partners probably the one of the most interesting, Chair. These are the different, I'll show you the different companies. We have 34 partners at this moment. Just to show you a few on this particular slide, Chair. The draft house incubation. In the malls, I'm sure you must have seen different malls, we have got our glass house, and that the glass house is built in such a manner that it shows people where you can physically touch and see and work and demonstrate or be demonstrated how the different products in the house can be the product, your feelings, your soul, and many other things that you can work with inside this glass house. That we move from one mall to another, and some of them are moved from one of our partners. You go into a company, and the employees in that particular company, the employees of the company that are members, are able to go to the house and be able to see all the product that are in the division. Partners that are activation, Anglo Ashanti, mining companies, banks, South African Airways. Advertising, where we have the advertising channel. This is important. We want to also go to the other part that is important here, which is where we did a study of the effectiveness of the campaign itself. We did digital Facebook, live 4,542, Twitter, 1,072 followers, website and pledges, 8,007. For example, website, the challenges, of course, Chair, are the same challenges. Get content, you know, message to South Africa rapidly, as widely as possible. Get consumers to adopt the principles of 49F. Partner challenges, slow takeoff, especially with their partners. Partners' willingness to promote and win externally and endorse the 49F. Most of them agree that inside in their own company, but what we also have to do is they must also become ambassadors, not only to talk about the campaign itself within their own company, but also to try and, when they go to market with their own product, they must go to market using also 49 million, very important for us, Chair. Issues and debate. Now, this is the part I wanted to mention, Chair, in the interest of time, is the study that we did around 49 million. The research objectives were to measure and determine the effectiveness of the 49M campaign among the South African population, to explore South Africans' awareness level of the 49 campaign, explore the knowledge and relevance of the campaign, explore the motivation to run the campaign, explore the behavior regarding electricity saving. This we did, I think, in October, November, we just received this at the end of December, so it's very fresh. The methodology, as we have there, the design of the methodology, the interviews 1,788, the data collection period 28 October to 28 November 2012. Key outcomes of the campaign, Chair. Aware of the 49M campaign, 73%. Knowledge of electricity savings being 97%. Relevance of the message communicated in the campaign, 91%. Motivation intent, inspired to switch current behavior, 92%. Behavior, actual electricity saving behavior, 96%. Those are unaware of the 49 campaign, 27%. Knowledge, 28%. Relevance, 57%. Motivational intention, 70%, and behavior, 36%. Key outcomes of the campaign. 22% awareness and 27% unaware. Most aware and most preferred media platform is the TV. Different media platforms serve different purposes, but as I said, the TV apparently is the most, the one that reaches the majority of the people and the most preferred by the audience. Knowledge, 90% of aware of consumers knowing what the campaign is about. The main message received, it is everybody's responsibility to save electricity. Every bit helps. I just provided, if you are not using it, switch it off. Key outcomes of the 49 campaign. Rated the campaign. campaign, 68% agree completely that it's a good campaign. No raising the pay for electricity, and therefore you don't have to save it, or that the campaign is a waste of money. The other way respondents do not find value or relevance in the end display. More intense or a different form of engagement is required for the unaware. General perception and motivation intent. Saving electricity is a collective responsibility. Main benefit of saving electricity is to save money. Chair, this is the what we, as I said earlier on, we try to one answer all the questions that were provided, but we made an addition because of the fact that we received the study to the special contact. It's a very comprehensive and around to the patient. Thank you very much, Chair. All readings for the question.
Thank you very much. Honour members, I'm looking at time. If I can confine members to two questions, each member. Just two questions. Quick. Oh, by the way, yes. Can I plead with people if they can stick around, because there's a lot that's coming out. I'm sure it's not just for our benefit, but each and every person who has come to make presentation can benefit from what other presenters are doing, because you come from different angles and from different sectors. Bearing in mind that it's not just for our benefit, it's for all of us, but at the end of the day, you know, we all have to drive energy. Thank you very much. Can we be back, please, by quarter past two?